If it's all right with you all, or with enough of you, I would like to, I'm interested in spending the evening having a more open format, to have either questions and answers or to have some discussion about some topic that seems interesting for you, instead of the regular kind of more normal Dharma talk. So that's what I had in mind. You could change that. I can give a talk, but I think it's good for us to periodically kind of just get a sense of the concerns we have as a community, or issues you might have about your own practice, and discuss those. Yes.
Well, following on the theme of this harvest dinner that we're having, which is sort of a pre-Thanksgiving opportunity for vegetarians, I'm wondering whether in the Buddhist tradition there are any typical events related to thankfulness, or any particular practices around gratitude, or
I don't know really well a lot of the customs in Buddhist countries in Asia. I mean, they have, you know, a lot of the customs that we have in their own way, in Buddhist garb, in Buddhist ways. What I do know is that a lot of them there are Buddhist holidays, and they're very much tied for most people. So there are Buddhist holidays. There's a celebration of Buddha's enlightenment, his birthday is Enlightenment Day. There's different days, like kind of very sacred for, holy or special for Buddhists in Southeast Asia, Theravadan Buddhists. And there's various things that happen in these days. Sometimes there is big festival days, and there'll be, you know, just huge festivals in the city streets. And if you go to Thailand on the wrong day or the right day, depending on what you think, chances are you'll get wet. People douse you with water or throw water balloons at you or something. It's part of kind of this big festival. And but what I'm most familiar with is that a lot of these days, and a lot of the ways in which more devout lay Buddhists celebrate them, is they go to a Buddhist temple, they go to a Buddhist monastery, and they often will spend the whole day there doing meditation or doing festivals or listening to Dharma talks or various things they might do. And in terms of gratitude, there's a couple of things that come to mind. One is last weekend, Tanisara Bhikkhu, Tan Jeff, had his what's called Katina ceremony, which around the same time they're also having at Abhyagiri. Every year the monastics, the monks and nuns, spend 3 months on retreat, or 3 months set put in their own monastery. They're not supposed to go traveling around, just have to be in one place. And at the end of that 3 month period, there is a time where they have this festival it's done different ways in different places. And part of that festival is kind of the monastics, the monks and nuns, asking for forgiveness for any ways in which they've transgressed during those 3 months that they're supposed to have been put. And so, you know, it's kind of usually ritual form. You know, they don't actually confess particular deeds, but there's kind of in a kind of ritual way they say, you know, for all the ways in which I might have transgressed, I want to ask for forgiveness from the lay supporters who supported us during this time. And during this Katina ceremony, is also, in addition to the forgiveness, is this extension of gratitude that goes back and forth between the monastics and the lay people. And often the lay people will come then bearing gifts to the monastery. And often they'll give, the monastery gets an abundant supply of toothpaste and soaps. And the traditional gift to give is cloth, so they can make robes from. but also then given money and many things. But it's partly a ceremony that expresses the gratitude all around of how people feel. In relationship to kind of like a harvest thing, most Asian Buddhists, and traditionally in Asia, Buddhism is very much tied into whatever the local spirit worship might be. Most countries in Asia will have some more or less indigenous belief about the local spirits. And in India they had that, and they have it in Thailand and Burma, they have it to some degree in China, they have it in Japan. And so Buddhism just assimilates rather than rejects. So if Buddhism stays long enough in America, it'll just probably just assimilate Christianity, and Buddhism tends not to want to exclude things, but rather find some ways to include things. And so part of this, in that indigenous culture, has a spirit worship, which is about the spirits of the land, spirits of the trees, spirits of the mountains. Then at various times, the Buddhist will often in part of the monastic life, will somehow express a respect or gratitude or forgiveness, asking for forgiveness to the spirits. So when I was in the Zen monastery in Japan, Zen in the West is characterized as being very, I don't know if austere is the right word, but kind of, it's Buddhism kind of pared down, and it's like, you know, there's very little extra. It's just, you know, you go into this very clear, clean, almost empty room, and you practice, and everything is superfluous from life, you know, from religious life, you just drop, because Zen just gets right to the point, right? And there's nothing extra, and just right now, just as it is. Well, if you go to Japanese temples, Zen temples in Japan, there's a lot of extra. It's just abundant with it. In Zen temples in Japan, they celebrate, they have, I went there, you know, we would do just monthly rituals, making offerings to the Hindu goddess for the Ganges River. What are we doing in this Japanese Zen temple honoring the Hindu goddess of the Ganges? Well, it's all incorporated, and there's built into. If you go to San Francisco Zen Center, for example, it's not explicit, but if you look in the corners of what they do there, there's all this complicated, esoteric and exoteric Buddhist and non-Buddhist kind of strands of teachings and practices that go on there. You can spend years there and not know that's part of it, and. When I was in the monastery in Japan, at the beginning of a three-month training period, there was an explicit honoring and expression of gratitude to the spirits of the land upon which the monastery was built. Because you were kind of you had to disturb them in order to kind of be there. And so you want to spend some time acknowledging that. Some people who would like to demythologize things will say this is just, you know, we'll find some other, say this is a kind of mythological way of talking about our connection to nature and the wider life, and there's important ways in which to honor it. So that was a very long answer that didn't really get to the point that well. Okay. Yes?
The issue of forgiveness is something sort of rattling around in my mind. Like, if somebody has done something which has offended you, how does one sort of forgive yet at the same time not welcome them back with a naivety that would make you vulnerable to the same thing happening again? Sort of forgiving yet not forgetting, or managing that sort of difficult boundary of allowing someone back in, so sort of letting go of the coals of resentment or unforgiveness, yet at the same time being more wary. This is something I'm struggling with at the moment.
Rather than being wary, what you answered it yourself earlier when you said forgiving but not forgetting. I mean, you're supposed to keep your good common sense, you know, and if your memory, and if someone has burned you a few times, and perhaps it's appropriate to forgive them, but not to forget, you know, it's like Charlie Brown, right? Every fall, Lucy says, you know, you know, come and I'll spot the football for you. And he never remembers. You know, he should say, well, he always believes that she's going to hold it there. And every year she pulls the football up and he goes landing on his back. So I think somehow remembering and I think it's, you know, forgiveness is not meant to be a certainly not meant to be a it's not a pardoning, or it's not a saying, oh, what you did didn't really happen, or what you did, you know, it's not excusing what the person has done. Forgiveness only works if there's a real clear acknowledgement that there has been a transgression, has been a problem here. And if you don't clearly see that, then you're not going to learn the lessons of how to take care of yourself in the future. If it's a kind of just forgiving and forgetting. But yeah, please.
I am so glad that this gentleman marked this question, but it still doesn't make sense to me. Yes, among God, ordinary people, yes, but how do you approach the leader who killed millions of people? How can I forgive him or forget, you know, not to forget? It just doesn't make sense to me in a, you know, bigger perspective.
Who's been telling you you're supposed to forgive? I mean, why do you think? Why do you think that you should be interested in forgiving?
Because it hurts me all the time.
Bingo. So your forgiveness is not forgiveness is only makes sense in my understanding of it. Forgiveness only makes sense in my understanding of it. And I'm not an expert on forgiveness, but it only makes sense if you're feeling resentful. If there's some holding inside of you, if there is that resentment inside of you, then forgiveness is the releasing of that resentment. And you do it as much for yourself as you do for the other person, the release of that resentment. So forgiveness is not excusing someone. It's not saying it was okay what you did, but it's kind of saying, I'm no longer going to keep my heart closed because of what you did. And so there's certain things that need to happen that makes it to make it easier for forgiveness. One of them is to know that the transgressions, the abuse has stopped. And there's been beautiful examples of people who have seemingly forgiven the unforgivable. Probably some of you saw in the Chronicle on Sunday the story of, I don't know how to pronounce their last name, Amy Buell. She was a Stanford student. She's a Stanford student who some 6 years ago was murdered in South Africa. And she was down there trying to help during the time when the white supremacist government was running the place. And she was working with the local black communities. And there was a lot of anger towards whites, and some of the local blacks didn't realize who she was and that she was there to help them, and so they killed her, and they ended up in jail. And then her parents ended up going to South Africa and eventually forgiving and eventually hiring and becoming very close to her their daughter's killers. And there's a lot of examples, phenomenal examples, where people have actually gone out of their way to heal the anger, the hurt that they've had, and then extended themselves to help someone else. In places like El Salvador and Guatemala, phenomenal stories of forgiveness, of people, atrocious things that were happening. I think the process has a lot to do, helps a lot, if you, rather than focusing on the other person so much, you focus on what's going on inside of you and to find out where you're closed. And if you can understand that well, then I think forgiveness is probably easier. Yeah.
I'm wondering if there are any practices or rituals for when you're ill and dying.
But maybe just to kind of finish the talk about forgiveness. Maybe other people have questions in a little while, but I was thinking of inviting this guy, Fred Luskin to come and talk to us. You like that? He's going to give a talk Wednesday. You know him?
I work with him.
Oh.
He has a book coming out very
soon. Yeah, so he wants to go around. He's kind of available these days to go around. He's actually speaking Wednesday morning in Portola Valley from 10 to the Presbyterian Church from 10 to 12. So are there rituals and practices for death and dying? There's lots of them, because that's one of the functions of at least Buddhist spirituality often, is to be present and available at times of death and these important transitions. So much so that in Asia sometimes Buddhism is associated with death and dying. In Japan, for example, Buddhism is often associated with Shintoism associated with birth, Christianity with weddings, and Buddhism with funerals. It's true. I mean, you tell someone, you know, I was a Zen priest in Japan, and I would tell someone that, you know, I'm a Zen priest, and they thought that was really weird. I mean, that was, you know, it's like, I don't know what it'd be like, but it's like someone coming to America, and you ask them, what are you? And they would say, I don't know. What?
An undertaker.
I don't know. I don't know if this came to mind. I don't know if it's all right, but it's like someone comes to America and says, what are you? And I'm an Amish. I decided to become an Amish and come to America to study Amish, you know, the Amish religion. And, you know, it's like, I guess it's probably a great thing to do. Probably more of us should do it. But it would kind of be a... But anyway... So the question is death and dying. It's understood that one of the most important things you can do is practice mindfulness. So for the people who have a strong mindfulness practice, it's the most beneficial thing you could do. And one of the reasons to practice mindfulness and develop it as a real skill that you have under your belt is in preparation for when you're going to die. People who have very strong mindfulness practice, nothing else is needed in terms of ritual or preparation. In some Buddhist countries, the more developed a person is in their spirituality, the less ritual they do for them as they're dying or once they're dead. If someone is, for example, a monk, in some countries like Korea, if it's an ordinary person, you might do a lot of ceremony, I've been told. If it's an ordinary monk, you do some ceremony. If it's, a monk has been around for a long time, you do a bit less. And if it's someone who's recognized as being kind of an enlightened abbot, you're supposed to do almost nothing at all, because they don't need it. One of the things that happens during dying, besides mindfulness, is a recollection of your own good deeds and good qualities. To remember and think about the good deeds and good qualities of your life, it's supposed to be very beneficial for that process of dying. In part because traditionally in Buddhism, what you think about, or what's on your mind when you die, is one of the major conditioning factors for how you're going to get reborn. And so you want to be very careful what you do with your mind during those last period. And so often Buddhist teachers, monks, and nuns will come to your bedside and ask you to remember the good deeds of your life, or your good qualities, or to remember things that kind of inspire the mind. So it's often a time when Buddhists will chant the sacred chants in ways to inspire their mind, put it in a good frame of mind. They'll recollect the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, do various recollection practices. And some Buddhists, customs for some Buddhists is at the foot of your bed, kind of like on the wall, you'll put a big painting of some sacred Buddhist image, like the Buddha, for example. So you can be looking at that, and that can kind of make for a more happier or more enlightened state of mind as you're dying. The idea of merit making is very important in Buddhism, so that making offerings is supposed to be very beneficial for this process of creating good conditions for your mind. Um, But I'm curious why you asked that question.
I listened to a lecture yesterday at Green Gulch, and they were talking about the Suzuki Roshi when he died, and I guess he said to somebody that he didn't want to die. And I was just thinking about it, and I just was thinking about my feelings of self and not self, and trying to figure out things, you know, like my sense of self, and just trying to figure out that maybe it is attributed, it's more like my breath than the sense of real self, and thinking those questions about not having a self, but of all these things that define us, that we define, that used to define ourselves, so we can all be broken down.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, if you're lying there in bed, you know, dying, what do you do?
Die. I think it's a good question. What do you do as you're there lying, dying? What do you do, you know, when you're lying there living? It's very much the same, I think. I mean, I haven't died that I remember. And some people, you know, have die, right? You've died, right?
I mean, your
heart stopped.
Oh, yeah, several times.
Yeah, sometimes your heart stopped. I guess she wasn't quite clinically dead, but...
No,
sorry, I assume maybe I shouldn't bring it up while we speak. Sorry. Ask for forgiveness.
I think there's an altered state that one finds or goes through, and I think that what Gil said is true about the mindfulness being prepares you maybe for that, to be aware and not be frightened by what you see or go towards something you might notice, but just to be ever so present. And I do think that the positive states, the qualities of mind, are really, really important as you make that transition.
I haven't, that I remember, and they've gone, been, you know, been aware of my own dying. But it's my faith that what happens in deep meditation is probably very comparable, very similar, maybe the same as what happens while you're dying. And in terms of having to let go, dying is partly letting go. And so if you have the time to die slowly, there's kind of often kind of a slow letting go of much of our identity, many things we hold on to. And there are things that we'll hold on to very, very tightly when we have a lot of time to live, but they're easy to let go of when we're close to death. And then there's some things which are hard to let go of even close to death. And the same thing with a deep meditation. It's very hard to let go of some things which we really feel we need for our security, for our identity. And so if a person really does the meditation path really thoroughly, I think that they won't be afraid of dying. Or when dying happens, they'll be familiar with the process, if dying happens slowly enough, if they're lucky, and they can kind of be awake while they're dying. And one of the very common practices in Buddhism is a whole series of different kinds of practices having to do with contemplating death. So rather than just waiting for death to happen, a person will reflect on death in various ways. And not to be morbid about death, but partly to understand where we are attached today, and to help us to free us up from these things. I believe that, now that I'm starting to get a little bit older, it occurred to me that one of the reasons why the elders in our society, as we get older, why there's more, we traditionally think that they have a lot of wisdom. I used to think that it was because they'd lived a lot and been seen a lot and had a lot of experiences to call upon for their wisdom. And I think that's part of it. But I'm beginning to suspect that it has also something to do with the proximity to their own death as we get older. And there's a whole different perspective we have on what's really important in life when we reflect on life in contrast to death, to our death, and death around us. So it isn't just simply to wait until you die to do those kinds of practices, you know, But really, it's a matter of hopefully dealing and facing these things while we're still quite healthy. Yes?
You mentioned what people do for somebody who's died, a ceremony or something. In this country, it seems like the ceremonies are more for the living. They're in the pain of mourning. But what is it that, for say, a person who isn't that spiritually advanced, whatever you do in Buddhism or other, what the people would have more of a ceremony for? What are they trying to, how are they trying to help the person, or what is it they're trying to help them do in trans, in moving on?
There's a traditionally there's a few different things that are done. One is that the transition can be very frightening for people, and there's a lot of places where as the consciousness leaves this life and somehow moves on, that there's a kind of transition period where things can be kind of rocky before you've kind of taken up birth someplace else. And the old habits of fear or greed might still be operating. And so to help a person with that transition so that what they're attached to, maybe they can encourage them to let go of it. And what they're afraid of, encourage them not to be afraid, tell them that it's okay. And so some of what happens during that transition, both before a person dies, as a person's going into death, you know, in Buddhism, since Buddhism traditionally doesn't have this idea of traditionally, Buddhism has the idea of rebirth. There isn't some definitive end, because it's just a continuity of sorts. And so the process of taking care of the person as they're dying continues beyond when we think they're clinically dead here in the West. And it's just encouraging them not to be afraid, encouraging them not to be attached, encouraging them to remember that which is most beautiful or most important. And for someone who's well-practiced, you might encourage them to remember the light of enlightenment, the light of awakening, the freedom, the peace. For someone who hasn't had much experience with practice, you might encourage them to, you know, reflect more on qualities of generosity, of love, and things like that. Also, there's a tradition of sharing merit with the deceased. That, and this is a little bit controversial, whether the Buddhist teachings really allow for this or not, whether the Buddha really taught this or not. So that, you know, but most Buddhists couldn't care less about the controversy; they just do it. So what this involves is a sharing of your merit. So those people who are still alive will do something meritorious, do something that's good. So the most common thing to do is to make an offering, to do dana. And so often for a funeral ceremony, the family will invite monastics to the ceremony. And part of the reason the monastics are there is to be the recipients of donations, because it's considered very meritorious to give to monastics. And then after you make this donation, then, you know, so if you've survived and someone you know has died, you make the donation, you then have received good merit. And then you turn around and dedicate that merit to the person who has died. So most Buddhists don't think, most lay Buddhists, kind of in the village level or something, don't think much more about how that works. It's just like, you know, of course it works. You know, just, you know. And then there's people who try to explain how this might work. And one of the ways they think it works is it isn't so much that it's something you have that you give to the deceased, but in that you are rejoicing, you're happy in having done something good. The disease somehow tunes into your happiness, and that makes them happy and more relaxed and settles them a little bit. So those are the two things that I know about. Dick?
I'm sorry, but I wasn't able to hear all of the announcement of this man who's speaking in Portola Valley on Wednesday, and couldn't catch his name, and I couldn't hear a lot of the conversation. Just didn't care about here.
Am I speaking too softly today? I am, huh?
Well, it wasn't so much yours as some of the other conversation would give a context.
Oh, I see.
I couldn't hear that because it was soft and directed towards the fireplace. His wife in the back row. Can you fill me in on that? And the rest
What's his name again?
Fred Luskin.
Fred Luskin. And he's a researcher at Stanford who studies forgiveness. And he does a lot of interesting work working with teaching people forgiveness. He's now written a book which is about to come out. And he's giving a talk Wednesday morning in Portola Valley. I think it's $20 to hear him speak at the Presbyterian Church near where we usually have our sitting Sunday morning, 10 to 12 o'clock. And it had occurred to me to invite him to come and speak in our group one day. So maybe we will.
How do you spell his last name?
Probably L-U-S-K-I-N.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gail, since we're on the subject of forgiveness again, and since some of the discussion might not have been heard, in the book discussion group, we're reading Sharon Salzberg's Loving Kindness, and there's just an incredibly relevant quote that I can read.
Please, yeah.
So the quote is, forgiveness does not mean condoning a harmful action or denying injustice or suffering. It should never be confused with being passive toward violation or abuse. Forgiveness is an inner relinquishment of guilt or resentment, both of which are devastating to us in the end. So that's kind of the discussion we had.
Yes.
In the summertime, a couple of Dharma talks, you mentioned that one of the most important things to have was a goal.
I did? Well, I hope you chose a good one then. Yes.
No, I was just, I sort of struggled with that.
Did you come up with a good one? Did you come up with a good goal?
Yeah, it's sort of generic, but it was sort of artificial. I sort of felt lost, really, in a way, whenever you said that. Both times I did. So.
What was the context for saying that? Or maybe someone else remembers. It's important to have, intention is very important. Intention, I guess, is closely connected to goal.
Right.
Buddhist spirituality puts a tremendous emphasis on intention. That in, our intent, one of the ways to discern whether our acts or actions are one of the ways to kind of make decisions in Buddhism is to look at what is our intention behind what we want to do. Is it motivated by intentions of greed, or is it motivated by intentions of generosity, for example? And to be very careful about the intention that is coming into play, and to reflect on our intention. I also often talked about how important it is to look at our deepest intention. What's the deepest intention for our lives? And what's the operating intention? Because it's one thing to have a deep intention, and it's another thing to actually live by it. And like you can imagine, an anthropologist from Mars, a Martian comes to the Earth, and studies you and kind of follows you around and sees everything. And it doesn't speak your language or anything, but just kind of sees all the things you do. And they go back and report, Ken, you know what, you know, it seems like his whole life is based on, you know, I don't know what you do, but you know, watching videos and going to McDonald's, you know, whereas they might see you, they come down from the earth on a different day, and they see, oh, his whole life is based on, you know, being kind and helping his neighbors and friends. But we can have an intention to be kind. We can have an intention to be better people. We can have an intention to become more compassionate, loving. We can have the intention to become freer, and then, or we cannot. And to find out what our intentions that we base our life on is very important. There's always something that we base our life on, and if we don't reflect very deeply about this, then it's often very surface motivation that runs our lives. Kind of gratification in the moment, or the messages from society kind of infiltrate into us, and we kind of become, you know, it's other people's intention rather than our own. So I might have said that rather than goal. Maybe goal and intention are closely linked. They are, I suppose. You want to come back with more, or do you want to say, yeah, because it probably wasn't necessary.
No, I understand what you mean now. I didn't understand what you meant, but I thought, well, I was supposed to have some kind of goal in my practice or in, so this makes much more sense to me.
The issue of goal in practice is an important one. You find different Buddhist teachers taking different positions about the role of a goal in Buddhist practice. My early Buddhist practice was in Zen Buddhism, in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, and it was very clear there, the message, that there should be no goal when you practice. And it's a goalless practice. As soon as you have a goal for your practice, then your practice was off. And if you really want to wake up and be free, you can't have any goal. It's fully being present for how things are right now, as they are. To have a goal means you're somehow concerned with what's in the future. And then you miss the present because of that. Other teachers put a tremendous emphasis on goal. That, you know, it's inconceivable for them that practice is about having no goal at all. Practice is all about a goal, the goal of nirvana, full awakening. When I was in Burma, my teacher would end, sometimes he'd end his interviews with me and said, "Gil, strive for nibbana." You know, that's kind of like really having a goal. You know, Suzuki Roshi never would have said strive for nibbana. He would have said nibbana's right here or something. So then the question is, are they very radically different messages, or are they different perspectives about the same thing? And one of the ways to reconcile this is that that I find very helpful is that it can be very appropriate to have certain goals in our lives. How we hold those goals is very important. You can be filled with attachment towards the goal. That goal could be tied into all kinds of neurotic senses of self-identity. You know, if I get this goal, if I'm the first one on my block to get enlightened, you know, then you know, I'll be popular at parties. You know, people recognize that I'm really cool, or, you know, there's all kinds of reasons that are extra around why a person might have a goal. But you have to be careful about how we hold the goal, what our relationship is to it. There are different levels to our activity, in a sense, or different kind of. If you think of ourselves as kind of being concentric circles. So, say, for example, you want to, it's really important for you to get enlightened, to really have that freedom that's possible with the Nibbana. And so that's what gets you to come to a meditation retreat, what gets you on the cushion. However, once you're on the cushion, you have to forget about your goal. Because then the goal is going to get in the way. But the goal got you to the cushion. So there's kind of like in the widest circle of how we organize our life, certain goals can be very useful. But when we get down to actually doing the practice moment by moment, it's very important to know that then you have to let go of any notion of a goal. So that heals that division a little bit. It allows for both, you know, in different contexts, it allows, you know, for both having a goal and having no goal. But you have to be very careful with goals. Intentions are a little bit safer. They overlap, so. Yes?
What happens if your intentions are in conflict with a situation? So, you know, and your intention would be, you know, for the greater benefit of this person or this situation, or, you know, of all beings that are involved in it. But suppose. I don't know, suppose the way that you choose to carry that out is not, I mean, it runs into conflict or it's not exactly what they want.
I don't know how to answer that. It's very, you know, of course it's very dangerous to have ideas of what other people should be like or have. I think that maybe one way of looking at this is to scratch underneath the surface of that intention, see if you can get deeper into the intention. And see, not what the intention is in terms of what the result you want, in terms of some world, some change in the world, but rather what is the motivation within you for wanting that to be that way? Are you being motivated So maybe you want the person to be happier in some ways, but what's motivating you to want that intention for that person? Is it because you're afraid for that person? Are you afraid of yourself? Is it for your self-identity? Is it because you're uncomfortable yourself and some aversion to the unpleasant situation? So the exercise in with mindfulness is always try to come back as deeply and personally as you can. What is it that's motivating you in the situation rather than what you want for the situation? Can you see the difference between that?
Mm-hmm.
And the situation is, you know, that's complex. Well, I hope this was very nice for me to hear from you, to hear the kind of concerns you have and questions you have, and I hope that it was interesting enough for all the rest of you instead of having a regular talk. And we did this yesterday also in Portola Valley, did questions and answers. And part of my, it was a little bit more on my mind yesterday than it was today, but part of my idea of doing this is just kind of being open to whatever might come up out of discussion. I'm actually still quite concerned about how individuals here and how we as a community are handling the whole thing of war and terrorism and the economy and job losses and as I've said maybe last week, that there's more anxiety now. I feel more anxiety in our community, in our particular meditation community, than I've ever felt in the 11 years I've been teaching. And people come here partly as a resource and during time of stress and difficulty. And so maybe I should have made it more explicit at the beginning that that was one possibility to go in that direction. But if any of you feel like you have like our community or like someone within our community for us to have some kind of meeting or gathering or maybe outside of Monday or Sunday or Thursday, maybe in one of these normal sittings to look at these issues and our feelings and practicing with it, let me know. And then we can see about maybe organizing something at some point. Yes?
I just went to a meeting yesterday where it was really focused on terrorism. And what I found was it was so helpful to go back to it again because, we talked about it a lot when it first happened and then afterwards and that first month. And then took a break and going back to it again, it felt really deep. I was still really, crying and upset.
I think it's very, I think exactly you spoke very well. And one of my concerns kind of is the person who's kind of trying to figure out how to do our Mondays and Sundays and stuff is I'm aware with a large group like this, there's a lot of very varied needs that people have. And some people very much want to come to a community like this and come to process what's going on. And some people, this is the last place they want to process because this is the refuge of just being quiet and being silent in it. And so there's a kind of desperate needs in a community like us. So so not always clear to me, which is most useful for us to, what's most useful to address. But that's why having people here, anybody wants to talk to me afterwards with their ideas, what their needs or requests are, we could either at some point do something on a regular evening again, like we did right after September 11th, or we can just set up a different meeting some other night of the week, and those who are interested in coming can come. Yes?
The examiner coming report, the first part series for what people can actually do. So people find that doing something helps them feel better, you might pay attention to the people. It started today. Today was about the water and I don't know what's tomorrow, but...
Great. Thank you. So, how is Rainbow?
Yeah, something I wanted to announce that I forgot earlier when I started the topic, but
or if anyone is going on Thursday night, either here or Saturday, or the Sunday sitting, and you're willing to take some of these flyers, that would be useful to spread the word.
So may whatever merit we've made from this evening of practicing together, may we share it for the benefit of all beings everywhere. And may we carry with us seeds of goodness and generosity and kindness to all the people that we encounter as we leave. And may you all have a happy week. Thank you. Thank you.